This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Ministry with Community of Kalamazoo Executive Director Rob Oakleaf discusses plans for a new facility. But first, Jeffrey Wigand became toxic to tobacco companies after leaving his job as a research executive at Brown & Williamson. He cooperated with the government's investigation of the tobacco industry. Wigand's decision to go public and the controversy over his interview on CBS's 60 Minutes was the subject of the movie The Insider. Now Wigand is based in Mount Pleasant and runs the nonprofit organization which he founded, Smoke Free Kids. Jeffrey Wigand will speak at Western Michigan University on Tuesday. His address is titled Inside the Tobacco Industry. Jeffrey Wigand, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon, and good morning.
A question I like to ask someone whose story has been told in a movie is, if that is the only thing that someone knows about you, is there something you'd want to clarify or correct or perhaps fill in some details that you think don't come across well in that on-screen presentation?
Boy, I've never been asked that question. Let me see. I had very little, if anything, to do with the movie The Insider. In fact, I was blocked from cooperating at all with Michael Mann and Eric Roth, who was both wrote the script, and then, of course, Michael Mann produced it and directed it.
Blocked because of your separation agreement from the company?
No, it was because I had a temporary restraining order from a Kentucky court. And so the only really intervention I had was through my lawyers in Washington, D.C., when I became aware that they were making a movie. I wasn't really aware of it until my lawyer said, well, there's a movie going on about it, we need to talk. And then they set up a meeting to meet with Michael Mann in Washington, D.C., and I got to understand a little bit about what the movie was about. And I really had three very specific, I guess, criteria in terms of what was said in the movie and how it was said. And one was that there'd be virtually no gratuitous smoking in the movie or tobacco use, number one. Number two, my daughter's names would be altered such that they weren't using their real name. And third was that the nature of my one daughter's illness, which in the movie is portrayed as asthma, would not be treated as what it is. And that was the only three caveats that I had in terms of the movie and interaction in the movie. The rest of it came vis-a-vis the Marie Brenner article and the man who knew too much, and through the her participation in the movie, as well as Lowell Bergman's participation in the movie. The movie has helped me immensely in terms of my work and international recognition of what went on with me in the tobacco industry and also the media at the time. I mean, the capitulation of CBS 60 Minutes was just, I mean, it was like throwing gasoline on the fire. And then the release of the secret confidential deposition that I did in Mississippi when it was released to the Wall Street Journal. The ability of the media, which is something that is really contentious these days, of media really working with and helping people of conscience. That I use that word rather than whistleblower or snitch or tattletale, because I don't think one who puts public interest ahead of their own personal safety or job needs to be dealt with in a pejorative term. So I don't like the term whistleblower. I like the term person of conscience, because I think that's really what people who come forward with knowledge that is in the interest of public safety and health, and that's what I did.
Well, for other entities out there that may be talking with someone, a person of conscience, to use your term there, you know, how can we encourage more people to perhaps tell us the secrets that we should know about things that are affecting public health and safety? The media, of course, is probably a good place to start. What can the media do to make it somewhat easier for someone who has a pretty big secret under their wing to get it out there and make sure that the public knows?
Well, first of all, I mean, I talk to almost on a weekly basis to a number of people who are deliberating on coming forward with information to public interest. I mean, I really have to admonish them in terms of, you have to understand that once the toothpaste is out of this tube, your life is significantly changed. And you need to carefully think of what you're doing. Make sure that what you're saying is the absolute truth, because if it's not, it will not sustain the life cycle of what you bring forward, and you will be significantly harmed in the process of not dealing with something that factually and honestly. There is a lot to be said about people who are coming forward. I mean, I know many of them. I've worked with many of them. Some of them have come forward and some of them haven't. There is an absolute need for belief that what you're doing is the right thing. You have to understand that it's really taking your life and turning it upside down, both for you and your family and your acquaintances and your friends and whatever, and you need to be able to deal with it. I was very fortunate. I mean, I had 153 students that I was teaching at the time at a high school of excellence, a national excellence in Louisville, Kentucky, who were just my support every day. They were my psychological crutch, so to speak. So were the teachers and the principal of the school. I mean, even in the death threats that came to the school for me, they still stuck by me. So I owe them a debt of gratitude that I'm not so sure I'm ever going to be able to repay. I mean, there were lawyers that stood behind me. There were private lawyers. There were lawyers from the Department of Justice that stayed behind me, the judge that protected me. I mean, all these things that happened, the media was definitely behind me because I helped them in a process when documents were released. I became the navigator and translator of documents that were coming out from the tobacco industry that really showed the archaeology of at least 5 decades of deliberate conscious fraud. And without them, I mean, I'm not quite sure if you would be having this conversation with me, Gordon, because I would have probably wound up in the trash can. I mean, the smear campaign that the Wall Street Journal debugged, the need for armed bodyguards on a daily basis that changed the way we lived, the way we went to the store, the way my girls went to Girl Scouts, the way I drove, checking the mail, following me to school, I mean, you have to understand that once you do it, depending on the level of the 800-pound gorilla that you incite, that you got to be ready for it. I am immensely thankful of where I am today to the efforts of many other people that helped me. And I tried to share with people that it's not all the glory of a movie.
Despite all of that upheaval in your personal life, in your family life, there's a series of frequently asked questions on your website related to the movie The Insider. And the last one is, would you do it all again? And your response is, in a New York minute. Why?
Yep. Why? First of all, it was the right thing to do. It was in the interest of public health and safety. The knowledge that I had, if I kept it secret as they wanted me to keep it secret, I would be nothing but a bystander and just as guilty as those that were committing the fraud and selling a product when users intended kills not only the user, but the innocent bystander for profit. And so, again, a New York minute, the shortest minute. And I believe it has made a difference in my life. It has saved lives. It has changed the dynamic on a worldwide basis of what goes on in terms of regulating this industry that for decades has really sold a product that kills people.
When you come to Western Michigan University, students who may attend your lecture probably were either not born yet or perhaps were very young children at the time that you brought this information to the public. And I guess I'm wondering if they might think that this is stuff that they've heard before. How much do you think things changed from that moment in the mid-90s when we started to learn about what the tobacco companies knew and when they do it to now?
Well, you're most certainly right. I'm sure most of the students at 98 and were probably just being in grade school. So, I mean, I'm going to talk about Putnam's bystander. That is somebody who watches a harm and does nothing. To talk about it in terms of the ethics of doing the right thing. And sometimes the right thing is not always easy. And hope they walk away, at least with the understanding that they have an obligation when, as they go forward, whether it's in medicine, dentistry, business, or farming, that if they see a wrong, that they right that wrong by taking the appropriate steps.
I know you don't work for them anymore, but do you have any sense as to whether there has been a change at all in corporate culture with the tobacco companies, or are they still doing their best to make sure that damaging information, information that we should know from a public health standpoint, is not getting out?
Yeah, being a leopard has not changed its spots. Let's make that abundantly clear. I mean, they're back to doing the same thing they did before. If you just have to look at the new innovations of nicotine delivery devices, such as the e-cigarette, gateway products of dip and chew and sticks and flavor strips, they continue to produce products that either initiate or are suitable for initiation in terms of nicotine addiction to actually graduating over time to a product that they sell, which is a tobacco product, which is immensely profitable. So they have continued to do what they've done in the past. They obstruct smoke-free ordinances. They obstruct the WHO's framework convention for tobacco control in countries. They continue to influence using their lobbying efforts to really stop any kind of regulation. So they continue to do what they've done in the past. I mean, they have lots of money in spite of the reduction in the United States of tobacco. There's plenty of developing countries that they go to now and market their product. The industry has not changed totally, but it's changed in some places like Australia and New Zealand and the work I did in Canada and in Holland. And I mean, I just go on. I mean, I've worked with a lot of international ministers of health from Malta to Germany to Ireland to Iceland. And those environments have changed, which is immensely satisfied that I've helped change, but I'm only a catalyst in those things. But, you know, I don't have the resources of the industry, and a lot of what I do really relies on the ability of others to use their moral courage and sometimes their assets. Now, back to inside the industry, nobody will come out again. I expected, and I guess I believe that after 4 years, I mean, I wasn't a know-it-all. I knew a lot. I mean, I had access to things that other people didn't, but people that are there 20, 25 years knew that there was an internal mantra: we're in a nicotine delivery business, it's addictive and it kills people. But outside, they denied it. There was a schizophrenia. I expected that when I came forward, that others would come with more knowledge than I had, where all the rabbit holes are, where the things were swept under the rug, or where the secrets were that I did not know. But they all came out ultimately in the document. So if you get discharged from it or leave a tobacco company today, the secrecy tie-up just binds you forever. So they change their agreements and how they deal with people and what they have access to. There are also now silos of knowledge, and those silos don't really communicate with each other. So inside the industry, I don't think much has changed in terms of personnel management. And externally, they continue to do what they do best. They market a product that's addictive, that sells and continues to sell.
Silos of knowledge because they don't want someone else to be, to quote the article in Vanity Fair, the man who knew too much.
I think that's true. I mean, I did know too much. And that knowledge has benefited many people, from our own government to the government, around the world, Gordon. I mean, that knowledge has gone to help people. It's helped the Department of Justice in suing the tobacco industry for fraud and being labeled a racketeer in the federal lawsuit that was heard in Judge Kessler's courtroom in Washington, D.C. That's still going on. That is going to change it. The laws that were promulgated by the U.S. Congress on giving the FDA the authority over tobacco, while up to date they've been somewhat ineffective, but that power sits there. They need to go ahead and start using that power, as other countries have done. They have not changed the labeling because the industry fought it on First Amendment. They need to go back and assert that this saves lives. But it's going to happen. I mean, this is an industry that's 200 years old plus, and my expectation is it would change immediately. But I've learned that maybe it's going to take a generation to change. But it's changing. Go to Australia. Go to Ireland. Well, I went back to Ireland, and to go into a bar that sells Guinness by the pint, and nobody's smoking in it. A year before the ordinance, people were smoking and drinking their pint of Guinness. You couldn't get a reservation in a restaurant because it was packed with people who wanted to have a good meal without dealing with the effects of secondhand smoke. I've been the instrument or the catalyst with that knowledge that actually is changing the dynamics of it. It's slow, but effective.
And is that the work you're really doing right now with Smoke Free Kids?
I'm doing a number of things with Smoke Free Kids. One is, I really work with children around the world. Last year, I spent 3 weeks in Japan, and I dealt with doctors that are established, students that are going to become doctors or nurses, and children in fourth, fifth, sixth grade that are the target. So I work with children. I work with people that can affect the policies that affect children, such as smoke-free environments, no smoking in your car, with children tied down in the back seat, lots of things that involve not only using litigation. I'm an expert witness in many litigations that actually continue to keep that fire going of how the industry behaves, and has actually been an asset to change many things. I talk to people of potential whistleblowers. I talk to people in media that don't know how to interpret a document. I mean, around the world, and much of it comes from not only the 60 Minutes and the CBS public image, but also what the movie did. It raised it to a totally new level. The movie gets, every time the movie is shown anywhere, like it's being shown in Montreal, and I have to say my email today is just packed with questions and thank yous. So I continue to get it, and people, I have to say, continue to pass on the accolades for something that I believe was the best thing in my life to do. It was more reward than any job I've ever had.
Jeffrey Wagan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. Have a good day.
Jeffrey Wagan is a former tobacco company research executive, teacher, and the founder of the nonprofit organization Smoke Free Kids. He will speak on Tuesday at Western Michigan University. Links with more details about Jeffrey Wigand's address can be found at wmuk.org.